And welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you hear the latest on a Lake County assistant jail warden being demoted after extended contact with a former inmate. Justin Hicks reports the Department of Workforce Development is requesting funds from the federal government to give unemployed Hoosiers an additional $300 a week. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Purdue University professor Nikki Jackson about an upcoming virtual discussion series titled Race, Racism, and Anti-Racism. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Newly released disciplinary records show Assistant Warden Jose Menaca had extended contact at the Lake County Jail with a former female inmate. Menaca, who remains employed as a sergeant with the county jail, was demoted and suspended for 5 days earlier this year after an internal investigation found he violated department policies and professional standards. Police disciplinary documents dated December 17, 2019, were recently released to The Times in response to a Freedom of Information Act request. The report provides some insight into Menaca's misconduct. However, nearly half of the narrative of what transpired is redacted. The Times reports Menaca violated policy by initiating and having extended contact with former inmates on October 21st, 2019, for a period of approximately 2 hours and on October 24th, 2019, for a period of approximately 1 hour. About three lines of the report are blacked out or redacted. The nature of the contact with the former inmate is not clear. The disciplinary report states Menaca did not have an established personal relationship prior to the inmate's recent confinement at the jail. Sheriff Oscar Martinez said the internal investigation found no evidence that the interactions amounted to sexual misconduct. Menaca, a longtime veteran with the Sheriff's Department, was hired as a correctional officer in 2004 and later appointed by Martinez in 2017 to the position of assistant jail warden. He also temporarily oversaw the lockup's operations while a replacement could be found for the then jail warden, Ed Davies, who Martinez fired in late 2017 for failing to meet the U.S. Department of Justice's minimum requirements for jail administrators. In January, Menaca was demoted back to jail sergeant.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The City of Gary's police and finance departments are the latest targets of two grand jury subpoenas served on City Hall on Tuesday. Corporation Counsel Trent A. McCain told The Times on Tuesday night, quote, "I cannot disclose the individuals targeted, but can say with certainty that they were within the Karen Freeman Wilson administration." The two-term mayor, Freeman Wilson, led City Hall for 8 years up until December 31, 2019, after she was defeated in the last election. This marks the fourth publicly disclosed round of grand jury subpoenas served on the Prince administration for documents preceding his time in office. The subpoenas sought records dated between January 1, 2012 and December 31, 2019. Three other subpoenas have been received since January 1st, and all sought documents within that similar time frame. The news of more subpoenas served on City Hall comes on the heels of Mary Cossey, a former city employee and close ally to Freeman Wilson, being charged with felony wire fraud. Cossey worked for Gary government for a few short years under Freeman Wilson's administration, first in a newly created position of Director of Constituent Services in 2013. She's accused of concealing hundreds of thousands of dollars in income as well as assets as she went through bankruptcy and concealed a secret lending relationship with an individual A. McCain said the latest subpoenas are unrelated to the Cossey investigation, but he declined to say the individuals being targeted in the latest round. McCain said the latest subpoenas are unrelated to the Cossey investigation. The Prince administration has said they fully intend to comply with any subpoena requests. State audits and police reports published over the past 2 years flagged the fiscally mismanaged city and its employees for funding misuse at Marquette Park, the Genesis Convention Center, and the city's finance department. A crumbling tax base, delinquent property owners, declining population, and low assessed values have long exacerbated the cash-strapped city's ability to operate.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Department of Workforce Development is requesting funds from the federal government to give unemployed Hoosiers an additional $300 a week. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports it will only go to those receiving $100 or more in benefits.
The Lost Wage Assistance Program will be available for out-of-work Hoosiers backdated to August 1st. Federal guidelines say workers must have received benefits of at least $100 under state or federal unemployment programs to be eligible. DWD Commissioner Fred Payne says unlike other recent unemployment programs, the money doesn't come from the Department of Labor. Therefore, it could take somewhere between 2 to 4 weeks to start making payments.
So it's going to take a little bit of extra effort on our part in terms of moving staff to build a new system, and that system requires us to look at some new infrastructure.
The program is set to last through the end of the year. However, it could end earlier if the FEMA fund runs out of money or Congress passes a bill to supplement unemployment insurance. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Members of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus say Governor Eric Holcomb's announced steps on addressing racial inequality are a start, but still far from what's necessary to fix the state's pervasive problems. Holcomb outlined about a half dozen specific actions in a statewide address. That includes equipping all frontline state troopers with body cameras by next spring, a public dashboard with racial disparity data, and a new cabinet post, Chief Equity, Inclusion, and Opportunity Officer. Black Caucus Vice Chair Earl Harris Jr. says that last item exemplifies the need to wait on a true verdict for Holcomb's plans. It only works, Harris says, if the right person is in the job and empowered to make change.
Have that community connection where they can have honest conversations with the community and then take that feedback and work with the governor's office and agencies to make those correct types of changes.
Harris says he's disappointed Holcomb hasn't responded to the Black Caucus's suggestions of banning chokeholds, no-knock warrants, and racial profiling. Administration officials say they're seeking an outside review of law enforcement training and use of force broadly, but that review will come from a law enforcement group. Harris says there should be civilian involvement.
This is not just a Black Caucus issue. This is a you're a citizen in the state of Indiana issue.
Democrat Dr. Woody Myers, the first Black major party candidate for the governor in the state's history, called Holcomb's proposals much too little, much too late.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A panel of Indiana lawmakers is beginning to recommend changes for the 2021 session to adjust to the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. But some of the initial recommendations made Monday are short on specifics. One of the committee's first priorities was how to adjust Organization Day, a technical meeting of the full legislature in mid-November. This year, it's likely the General Assembly will make major changes to state law and their rules on Org Day to, for instance, allow legislators to vote remotely if necessary. Representative Ed Delaney says it's important not to rush those changes through, even though any such bills would be passed on that single day.
I would hope there'd be debates or discussions so that we and the public can understand what we're doing to the system.
But there's also the question of how to even conduct Organization Day. Staff estimates say the full Senate can be in its chamber and observe social distancing, but the same might not be true for the House. Committee co-chair Matt Lehman says that's why the initial recommendations didn't include specific guidance for the chambers on how to conduct Org Day.
I just think we need to be able to be flexible to pivot and to change when it comes to session days, when it comes to alternative session days, when it comes to moving the calendar.
The committee did recommend the Senate impose a 10-bill limit on how many pieces of legislation each lawmaker can file. The House already limits its members to 10 bills.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb wants the Indiana State Board of Education to take steps to protect school funding this year. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports the school leaders say the move is not relieving their funding worries and could make some things like teacher pay harder to navigate.
Holcomb's plan would delay when students are counted, something he says would keep funding stable through the fall. His suggestion comes after a top lawmaker warned schools of possible cuts if they only offer online instruction this fall. Martinsville schools are starting online, but Superintendent Jay Arthur says student enrollment and the funding it determines also shapes other critical school decisions, which means delaying the student count day could make things like teacher pay complicated.
How do you negotiate something that you don't know and you don't have a final answer on?
Arthur says instead the state should call a special legislative session to solve the issue and offer schools much needed clarity and stability during the pandemic. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Purdue University Northwest professor Nikki Jackson.
Coming up in September and into the rest of the months following, Purdue University Northwest is going to be offering through its faculty members an interesting series of lecture discussions, which are entitled Race, Racism, Anti-Racism. And in general, because of our issues here, not only in Northwest Indiana, but around the nation and the world, this is a very appropriate topic. Faculty members from the school, from the College of Humanities, Education, and Social Sciences are going to be involved in this. It's a way to learn more about activists who are basically risking their lives for the sake of social justice. The series of discussions will begin on September 3rd. And you'll be able to see it. It'll be available by Zoom or Facebook Live as you choose to be able to join in. It's a free series of events. It's virtual, open to the public. And the first one, as we mentioned, is going to begin on Thursday, September 3rd. And it'll be the Return of Black-Led Grassroots Politics. And Glenn Ford, the executive director of Black Agenda Report, is going to be doing that. And our guest today is going to be doing the one following that. It's called Race and Wrongful Convictions. And Professor Nikki Jackson, who is a professor of criminal justice, is going to be joining Roosevelt Glenn, who is an exoneree, on this topic. And by the way, the conversation is going to be in the Zoom on Tuesday, October 6th, as part of the series. And Dr. Jackson, thank you for joining us here today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your interest, which is very deep, in the subject of wrongful conviction.
About 4.5 years ago, I read an article in the newspaper about a gentleman who had been wrongfully convicted for 24 years for crimes that he had not been committed. And I had to meet this gentleman, so I reached out to the reporter, and who then connected me to his attorney, and I met with Mr. Donald and sat down with him, I think a day or two after, and heard of what his journey has been like and how he lost 24 years of his life for crimes that he never committed. The guy had never even had a speeding ticket, to the best of my knowledge. So I had made some promises to Mr. Donald that I was going to be his voice and help make some change. And it was at that point that I started doing some research and recognizing that so many African-American males have been wrongfully convicted. And I also learned that most of our wrongful convictions in the state of Indiana had come from Lake County. And that was really bothersome as a professor at Purdue Northwest, in, you know, which is housed in Lake County, and wanted to better understand what was taking place. So I started this journey, and it's a very long journey, but made some changes, and one of the changes that I wanted to see was a compensation bill for folks who had been wrongfully convicted in the state of Indiana. And thankfully, got some senators to listen and state reps, and we now have a bill in the state of Indiana which will offer compensation to exonerees. The bill is not perfect, and we're still in works with some modification requests, but we'll see how that goes. So that's really how I started this journey, and I've learned a great deal about wrongful convictions. I have spent the past two to three months now interviewing exonerees throughout the country. I've interviewed about 40 or 50 exonerees, male, female, Hispanic, African-American, white, and just learning more about their ordeals.
Have you found that being an advisory board member at both the Indiana State Prison in Michigan City and also at the Westville Correctional Center has not only helped keep you up to date with what is happening, but has helped offer the help that you may need in talking with people to get them to talk about what their issues are?
Well, it's interesting. As an advisory board member through the Indiana State Prison and Westville Correctional Center, I have other advisory board members that I have reached out to for guidance and assistance. And I've been very grateful that these folks have been able to answer my questions. In fact, I remember asking the former superintendent of Westville Correctional Center if he knew one of the exonerees, and he said he did not. And I said, well, he was, you know, under your charge. And he said, that's a good thing that I didn't know who he was. That means he was never in trouble. So that was a an interesting, you know, comment. But I have, you know, I have definitely taken my experience as an advisory board and really restructured my thoughts and my approach as an advisory board member at the prison that, you know, than when I had started many years ago.
When you and Mr. Glenn come on for the conversation on October 6th, is there anything in particular besides what you've kind of mentioned with us here as we talk, but that you'd like to bring forth to the people that are participants as well as those who are watching and listening at the time?
Mr. Glenn's ordeal is very important for folks to understand how race has played a major factor in those who've been wrongfully convicted. We know that minorities, particularly African Americans, are much more likely to be wrongfully convicted. I think about this. The National Registry of Exoneration shows that about we have about 1,900 exonerees in this country. 47% are African American. And think about that, 47%, and 13% of our U.S. population are African Americans. So you can see how disproportionate these numbers are, right? These percentages are. We have way too many minorities sitting in prison, particularly African Americans, and we're finding that many of those who are incarcerated are there really unlawfully. They didn't commit crimes. I am on the board at the Caring Place, which is a domestic violence shelter in located in Valparaiso. And my background really has been domestic violence. And what I've found is that there is a very strong connection between domestic violence and wrongful convictions. So it's very interesting that my research has brought me to a different area of research, but they are both connected. I found that many of these folks who've been wrongfully convicted have been products of homes where domestic violence occurred. And for females who have been wrongfully convicted, the majority of them, actually everyone that I've interviewed thus far, have been they have been wrongfully convicted based on some type of an intimate crime, and later learned that no crime even existed. And so these women have spent many, many years in prison for crimes that weren't even crimes. One of the things that Mr. Glenn and I are hoping, to convey to those who are attending is how being black had impacted Mr. Glenn and his experience with the criminal justice system. I want people to understand that African Americans are much more likely to be wrongfully convicted for crimes, particularly murder, sexual assault, and drug crimes. In fact, innocent black people are 7 times more likely to be convicted of murder than white people. So those are innocent black people. And there's a host of reasons for that. But one of the factors that plays a role in why innocent black people are convicted of murder more so than white people is due to unconscious bias and due to explicit racism. Crime that we see high rates of folks who are wrongfully convicted, particularly African Americans, is sexual assault. Blacks are 3.5 times more likely to be exonerated for sexual assault. And what leads to these African Americans who are innocent being wrongfully convicted in sexual assault cases is mistaken identification. Unfortunately, victims wrongly identify the perpetrator. And then the third type of crime where we see high rates of wrongful conviction by race is we see blacks are much more likely to be convicted. In fact, they're 12 times more likely to be wrongfully convicted for drug crimes. Yet blacks and whites, studies have shown that blacks and whites can use drugs at similar rates, but blacks are 5 times more likely to go to prison. And the reason we see more blacks going to prison for drug crimes than whites, even though they're committing them at the same rate, is that police are more likely to arrest African Americans than whites. Moreover, they're more likely to patrol areas where African Americans reside compared to whites. So we have to make some changes. But there has to be some reform. And one of the things that Mr. Glenn and I will be talking about are some of the concerns that we have about the criminal justice system and its biases. We know that in Chicago, there was a commander, Detective Burge, John Burge, who in the early 90s, late 80s, I believe it was late 80s, mm-hmm. was torturing young African-American males into false confessions. He was forcing them to confess to crimes that they did not commit. And this was, this was happening, and people were not speaking up. And I think it's time for change. It's time for change, and we need some reform. And we want to make sure that the right people are in prison who've committed these crimes and not the wrong people. And these African-American males and females who have been wrongfully convicted have spent many, many decades in prison while the real perpetrator has been out on the streets. Mistaken identification is the leading factor in sexual assault cases among African-American males. So we have victims who mistakenly identify the perpetrator, based on dark skin, whatever type of hair, but they typically mistakenly identify African American males, and we found that's a huge problem. It's a huge problem among sexual assault victims. They are wrongly identifying their perpetrators, particularly in cases where the perpetrator is has been African American.
Well, Dr. Jackson, thank you for what you tell us now. And we're looking forward to your presentation working alongside Roosevelt Glenn, the exoneree, on the topic that you're going to bring up with the conversation series October 6th. And it's entitled Race and Wrongful Convictions. And I'm sure that it will fit in nicely with the rest of the series that begins on September 3rd that you and your colleagues with Purdue University Northwest will be able to offer to anybody that views it on Zoom. And thank you for speaking with us today about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Professor Nikki Jackson is a professor of criminal justice at Purdue University Northwest. She's been involved in the issues of wrongful convictions, and that is why she is going to be one of the participants in the series that begins on September 3rd that you can see on Zoom as well as join on Facebook Live as well. The other people that are going to be participating from Purdue University Northwest include Professor Lee Arts. He's a professor of communication. He'll be on November 3rd talking about media framing and the politics of racism. And then the series will wrap up on November 30th with Professor Kim Skypes, who's a professor of sociology, on how to talk about race in the 21st century.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.